It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
I'm Charles Payne.
I'm Martha McCallum.
I'm Greg Jarrett, and this is the Fox News Rundown.
Friday, March 8th, 2024. I'm Jessica Rosenthal. Did the Commander-in-Chief make his case for another 4 years after an energetic and political State of the Union address in this election year?
Biden showed off a feisty side. He showed off a political side where he was drawing contrasts on issues that Republicans, I think, have some vulnerability on.
I'm Chris Foster. The Oscars were on Sunday with big movies about a bomb and a doll and smaller movies fewer people have seen expected to win awards.
The reality is, though, like on a creative level, it's a strong showing for the Best Picture nominee. At least that part of it gives people a reason to celebrate. And if Barbie makes, you know, younger people tune in, then all the better.
And I'm Kennedy. I've got the final word on the Fox News Rundown.
President Biden opened the State of the Union by telling us that, like President Roosevelt did during World War II, he needs to wake up Congress and the American people about the threats we face.
Not since President Lincoln and the Civil War have freedom and democracy been under assault at home as they are today. What makes our moment rare is that freedom and democracy are under attack both at home and overseas.
He said January 6th and lies about the 2020 election posed the gravest threat to our democracy since the Civil War. He moved on to abortion, saying former President Trump brags about the overturning of Roe versus Wade.
Many of you in this chamber and my predecessor are promising to pass a national ban on reproductive freedom. My God, what freedom else would you take away?
And while inflationary pressures were not a focus of his speech, he did argue that he's focused on bringing costs down overall, like the cost of prescription drugs. The president also proposed addressing the debt, at least in part, by taxing billionaires and corporations at a higher rate.
Folks at home, does anybody really think the tax code is fair?
No!
Do you really think the wealthy and big corporations need another $2 trillion tax break?
No!
I sure don't.
But in the Republicans' response to the State of the Union, Alabama Senator Katie Britt argued that the president can't talk about inflation or economic pressures because he's a career politician and is badly out of touch.
It's been a minute since Joe Biden pumped gas, ran a carpool, or even pushed a grocery cart. Meanwhile, the rest of us see our dollar and we know it doesn't go as far.
So did the president's third State of the Union address connect with voters this election year?
This is one of the most political speeches I can recall in the many, many States of the Union I've witnessed and reported on in my career. But it was an effective speech, I think.
Josh Krasauer is Fox News Radio's political analyst.
That Biden showed off a feisty side. He showed off a political side where he was drawing contrasts on issues that Republicans, I think, have some vulnerability on, whether it's abortion rights, whether it's the Republican Party's view on Ukraine and funding for Ukraine's fight against Russia, defense against Russia's aggression, whether it's what happened on January 6th. Those were issues that Biden brought up at the outset and made Republicans, including Speaker Johnson, look a little bit uncomfortable and figured out when to stand, when to look bipartisan, when not to. He sat down for almost the entire speech with a few scattered applauses here and there. But look, this was a very political speech where Biden wanted to show off the fact that he is aggressively making his case for a second term and making the case that the economy and his stewardship of the economy is paying dividends.
He painted this very terribly stark picture that we're facing these unprecedented times. He said not since President Lincoln and the Civil War have freedom and democracy been under assault here at home and abroad. Saying if you think Vladimir Putin will stop at Ukraine, you're wrong. He also said, my predecessor and some of you here seek to bury the truth about January 6th, and I won't do that. I guess that felt very, very dark and opening the State of the Union with this message that we're not strong, that we're in trouble.
There was a lot of focus on national security, foreign policy, leading with Ukraine, and the fact that there's a fear that if Ukraine loses the war, Russia could threaten other NATO countries. So that was a very stark warning from the commander-in-chief. He also talked about the Middle East and the threat, the hostages that Hamas has held and murdered, and talked about putting pressure on Israel as well to deal with the humanitarian crisis taking place in Gaza. Talked about China and the threat it poses on numerous fronts. So this was a speech that was talked about the high stakes, not just on the international stage, but also domestically with the future of democracy in this country on the line.
I want to bring in my Fox News Radio colleague, Jared Halpern, Washington, D.C. correspondent. Jared, after the discussion about the threats here at home and abroad, mm-hmm. he moved on to discussing abortion, women's reproductive rights, highlighting the guests who were present who've either struggled to get an abortion in Texas or an IVF procedure in Alabama. It just reminds you that after maybe concerns about foreign policy, this domestic issue is really going to be a big issue that Republicans are going to be facing throughout this election year.
It's been a big issue since Roe v. Wade was overturned, and the president talked about that. He gave the history lesson. He said that, clearly those bragging about overturning Roe v. Wade have no clue about the power of women in America. He went on to talk about how reproductive rights were on the ballot, and they won in 2022 and 2023, and says that they will win again in 2024. Listen, we have seen pretty dramatic shifts of the political landscape, especially in kind of suburban areas. And a lot of that happened in the aftermath of Roe v. Wade. And so, listen, this is an area when you talk about, reaching out to Haley Republicans or moderate Republicans or independent voters, it's an issue that has hit. And clearly it remains to be on the forefront. You have seen Republicans kind of move quickly to try and reaffirm IVF after the Alabama Supreme Court ruling. And so it makes a lot of sense that if this speech is largely intended to kind of be a referendum on his presidency and a list of why he deserves a second term, that protecting access to abortion would be high on that list.
Yeah. Jared, the president didn't really address inflation, but he did posit what he wanted to do in terms of the economy, and that is raise taxes, specifically on corporations and the billionaires. We've heard this before in his term. This may not end up being anything more than a proposal, right? But I didn't hear anything else about addressing, $34 trillion in debt. That was one of the first things Nikki Haley mentioned in her, suspending her campaign speech.
Well, when the president talks about raising taxes, especially on corporations, a minimum tax of 25% for billionaires, that is addressing the national debt. He talks about how much that would cut the deficit by. Now, obviously, spending programs and other things probably are going to work against it. The other thing that he mentioned in the State of the Union that I had not heard before, at least kind of in a specific policy realm, was this idea of a temporary two-year tax deduction or tax benefit on mortgages. And it's another way in which President Biden has kind of messaged inflation, right? He talks about inflation kind of in a more macro sense about how much people are paying for things. So he'll point to bringing down the cost of prescription drugs is fighting inflation. It's not really what inflation's after, but
right, because that's more the Fed's purview, right?
Sure, like but he views exactly. But when you hear the president and you hear the White House kind of talk about inflation, they try and pivot a little bit to bringing down everyday costs, junk fees. The president talked a little bit about that. He's made that a big part of his campaign. Talks about bringing down student loans. All of that in the context of bringing down everyday expenses, a tax deduction for mortgages that's temporary for 2 years, I think would kind of fit in that category.
Josh, the border. The president tried to talk about it, right? He tried to turn things back around on Republicans, accusing them of failing to pass this most recent border bill. But in talking about it, he pulled out the pin that Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene had given him when he entered the chamber. It had Laken Riley's name on it. And I wonder if in that moment it was actually Congresswoman Green who came away with the win there, because you could see her say to him from across the room as he was speaking, "You let them in," meaning the undocumented migrants, one of whom is accused of killing Lakin Riley, the 22-year-old nursing student in Georgia. What did you make of that moment? It was pretty intense.
Yeah, look, border security, immigration, that is the biggest vulnerability for President Biden. The fact that he sort of mangled her name, that was sort of fumbling along with trying to respond to Marjorie Taylor Greene in real time during that moment. I'm not sure how that played to the average American voter who is concerned about the state of immigration and the fact that there are a lot of illegal immigrants that have just been flooding across the border and straining social services in a lot of communities across the country. I think that Biden also had a really good moment on immigration where he outlined the bipartisan or at least what was originally a bipartisan deal that James Lankford, the Republican senator from Oklahoma, helped negotiate.
Yeah.
And said all the provisions in there that would help deal with border security, hire more judges to handle a lot of these cases. And Lankford was seen on television saying, "Hey, it's true.
That's true.
Biden
right.
was right." And that was a powerful moment. And I think you could wouldn't be surprised if you see that footage in a campaign ad for the yeah. Biden reelection. So border security is going to be a vulnerability for this White House. Biden only visited the U.S.-Mexico border for the second time in his entire presidency this month. It's following Trump there, being very reactive to the issue. But it's one that, the Republicans' biggest enemy is sometimes themselves. And the fact that they couldn't say yes to a deal that was, frankly, the most conservative immigration bill that had bipartisan support I can remember in my time covering Congress.
Finally, Josh, we heard from Katie Britt, junior senator from Alabama, for the Republican response. She talked about what we've heard from a lot of Republicans about Biden's failures or what they perceive as Biden's failures having to do with crime, the economy, inflation. But she is from Alabama, and the state did just grapple with a court ruling that said frozen embryos for IVF can be considered children. I wondered, did you expect her to maybe talk more about women's reproductive issues, or is that maybe for a later date and she was just sort of setting the stage for, "Hi, I'm Katie Britt, and you're going to hear more from me"?
Yeah, no, the IVF ruling from the Alabama Supreme Court has been a political vulnerability for Republicans ever since the ruling came down. And even some of the more pro-life conservative Republican lawmakers have been distancing themselves from the decision. And even Alabama, the state legislature changed its law to ensure that those protections would remain even despite the ruling in the state. So she was not going to lean into, what was becoming a problematic issue for the party, even for folks who are pro-life conservatives. But she, I think she was on the national stage for the first time. She's on the list, to be Donald Trump's running mate.
Right.
And I think this was her moment to see whether she could shine. I thought, she had her moments. I think these are never easy addresses to give as the response, the person responding to the president. And I can't think of many people who have done well with it. She was very dramatic. She hit all the high points on policy, but I think a lot of people might remember her more dramatic delivery as if they do remember anything from this State of the Union response. And ultimately, look, I think I don't know if the needle got moved in any direction insofar as Trump's consideration of her as a vice presidential prospect.
Very interesting. Fox News Radio political analyst Josh Kosar, thanks so much for joining us. And thank you, Jared, our Fox News Radio Washington, D.C. correspondent. Thanks, gentlemen.
Thanks, Jess.
Thanks, Jess.
Jason in the House, the Jason Chaffetz Podcast. Dive deeper than the headlines and the party lines as I take on American life, politics, and entertainment. Subscribe now on foxnewspodcast.com or wherever you download podcasts.
I'm Dana Perino. Join me for my brand new podcast, Perino on Politics. As we analyze the 2024 election cycle, make sure you subscribe to this series on foxnewspodcast.com or wherever you download podcasts and leave me a rating and review.
This is Kennedy with your Fox News commentary coming up.
The 96th Academy Awards ceremony Sunday night. The number one box office movie last year, Barbie, is one of the 10 Best Picture nominees.
Hey, Barbie. Can I come to your house tonight?
Sure. I don't have anything big planned, just a giant blowout party with all the Barbies and planned choreography and a bespoke song. You should stop by.
Ryan Gosling's up for Best Actor as Ken and tells Fox after making the movie,
"And now Kenergy is something you can't help but see."
It came out on the same day as Oppenheimer about the development of the atomic bomb.
Are we saying there's a chance that when we push that button, we destroy the world? Chances are near zero. Near zero.
What do you want from theory alone?
Zero would be nice.
Director Christopher Nolan tells Fox,
"I know of no story as dramatic as the real-life tale of Oppenheimer. His involvement with the Manhattan Project in this crazy, desperate race against the Nazis to harness the power of the atom for the first time, and where that led and how that defined the world we live in."
Nolan's expected to win Best Director. Oppenheimer's expected to win Best Picture.
I mean, Oppenheimer seems to be the bomb, right? Sorry for the pun.
John Jurgensen's a reporter on the Style News desk at the Wall Street Journal.
It's the rare movie that, you know, dominated the box office and also, you know, had all the critics swooning and, you know, kind of also falls into that historical epic that Oscar voters love so much. So it does seem pretty much a lock for the big one, but you never know.
Yeah. Look, a lot of great performances. Cillian Murphy, obviously, is the odds on favorite to be Best Actor. Robert Downey Jr., Best Supporting Actor. And just a lot of stars, a lot of great performances in there. And just, again, a big story, a big spectacle. Let's go through the big awards, and you can talk about whatever you want. You can say what you think will win, what you think should win, whatever. Best Picture, we've pretty much covered. Director, I guess Chris Nolan for Oppenheimer.
Yeah, it seems like it's his year. He has been nominated before in this category for Dunkirk, and he's been nominated for other Oscars as well, but he's never won. You know, he's always seemed like a bit of an outsider sometimes when you think about the Oscar establishment, but it does seem like this is the one it's going to be for him. You know, it seems to have this Venn diagram of quality and history and just sort of technical achievement he's been able to marshal. And as you said, you know, talk about sort of like a small army of amazing stars in this picture as well.
Yeah. So Best Picture, Best Director, Cillian Murphy's going to win, I suppose. Has Robert Downey Jr. ever won an Oscar for acting?
It does seem like, you know, the consummate Hollywood guy seems to be the one who's going to, you know, take the trophy this year.
Of the acting awards, there does seem to be a bit of a horse race, if you buy into the pundit's predictions, for Best Actress between Emma Stone and Lily Gladstone for Killers of the Flower Moon.
I mean, they've been sort of neck and neck all season for award season, and those two really seem like the ones that everyone's like eyeing the closest. I mean, both like wildly different films, right?
And yeah, poor things, right? It's sort of a Frankenstein story.
Yeah, it's like a Frankenstein meets Barbie type story. And of course, Killers of the Flower Moon is, you know, about this super heavy chapter in American history. And Lily Gladstone, you know, would be the first indigenous woman to win this award. So that also adds some gravity to it. So it's kind of going to be, I guess it seems like what Oscar voters seem like they want to reward. I mean, Emma Stone seems like she's building this kind of career and has, you know, been in the Oscar race before too. So that could be part of it, you know. Who knows, though? It's like, think about Annette Bening, you know, Hollywood. She was nominated for the biopic Naiad, like, you know, consummate Hollywood legend there. So you never know if things like that could be like a spoiler type thing. But it does seem like Lily Gladstone and Emma are the ones to watch. But I'm going to guess that Lily's going to take it home. She won the Screen Actors Guild Award, and that seems to be a good indicator since the, you know, actors have such a huge emphasis on the voting here. I think it's going to be Lily.
Yeah, we talk about precursor awards where essentially the same voting bodies are, you know, like the Acting Awards, the Directors Guild Awards, the whatever awards. It would make sense. It would follow that those same people would win, the same winners would win at the Oscars too. Screenplay awards, anything else we should go through?
You look at like the supporting roles for actors. You know, we've mentioned Robert Downey Jr. likely a lot. I mean, I think the other one, of course, that does seem like a lot, but I think it will be, you know, one people are going to really support is Divine Joy Randolph for The Holdovers. I mean, she's just been sort of on fire throughout the award season too. And, you know, The Holdovers is one of those Oscar movies that I think voters really like. It's kind of like a throwback film and, you know, a feel-good film. And amazing scene if you know, Paul Giamatti becomes the dark horse to win over Cillian Murphy or something like that would be a surprise. But Divine Joy Randolph does seem like the one who's going to at least, you know, from a percentages standpoint, it seems to be she's going to be the one to represent that film on the stage on Sunday.
Yeah, and I didn't not mention her out of disrespect. I think I just, it slipped my mind because it was, it seems like such a foregone conclusion that I skipped over it. Let's talk about the business a little, since you write about the business a little. Are we in sort of a reset time? The Oscars were a time to celebrate the movies, but looking past that, production was shut down for 6 months by the writer's strike and the actor's strikes. Where are we with that? Have movies been held back a while production catches up? Is everything back to speed?
I mean, I think it's the Oscars are this great lens. Not only the celebrity and glitz get us watching, but it offers a moment of sort of retrospect, looking at the business, you know, what happened the year before and what's going to happen ahead. I think the whole Barbenheimer phenomenon, which was, you know, massive and really sort of a great thing to celebrate, also kind of hides the fact that things are in kind of scary shape right now in Hollywood. You mentioned the actor strike, the writer strike that shut down the business for, you know, much of the year last year. That essentially kind of emptied the pipeline, or at least pushed things back in the pipeline. There's a real deficit of big films coming. But more than that, it's like this kind of moment of like, what are we doing in Hollywood? You know, the superhero genre is spiraling. It remains to be seen if that can kind of like climb back up to the heights it once had. And also just because of the greater nervousness in the business, you know, these major entertainment conglomerates are very worried about where their money is going to be coming from as their, you know, streaming platforms stumble and sputter. And so that has put a lot of pressure on budgets across the board. So it's harder to get things greenlit, and things have to be sort of like a super package to get a green light from studios in the way that, you know, maybe a few years ago they would have. And, you know, this is happening in the TV part and also in the film part as well, too. So, you know, I think people are very concerned about what the year is going to hold. And it's easy to kind of hold on to these hits, like, you know, the performance of the second Dune that just came out and did quite well. But you look down the calendar at what else is coming out this year, and it doesn't necessarily bode that well for, I guess, Hollywood's complete bottom line.
Yeah, and there have been maybe not bombs, but certainly the Marvel movies, the bloom is off the rose there. Those movies for a lot of people are now feeling like homework instead of, you know, a fun thing to go do at the movies every 6 months or a year whenever they come out. Some of the Disney movies have not done as well as they would have liked recently. And I wonder if, like you said, studios, including, well, maybe there's an opportunity for an Apple or Netflix or an Amazon to jump in more. But are the other studios, the legacy studios, going to be holding on to their wallets a little bit until things shake out?
Yeah, I think that's the case. And in the meantime, they're still, you know, hanging their hats on the power of the franchise. And you know, that's been sort of a constant conversation in and around the business for so long, and it doesn't need to be going anywhere. I mean, look down the line this year, you know, is Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes going to get people excited? You know, another Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes, is another Godzilla movie going to get people excited? On one hand, you know, Barbenheimer, or at least Barbie, you know, showed the power IP. Like, you could do something really creative with it, and you could do something that turns into, you know, the biggest movie in the world. But that's doesn't mean that, you know, every IP movie that comes down the road is going to be like that. And in case that actually, you know, it's nearly the opposite. The formula is exposed, and the formula tends to wear thin too. So, I mean, on the plus side, you know, I feel like it was a good year for films. I mean, Barbenheimer kind of dominates the conversation, but if you run down the list of Best Picture nominees, you know, it's a pretty solid list. Even though, you know, a lot of regular moviegoers probably haven't seen these films.
Right.
You know, when you get down to things like The Zone of Interest and American Fiction and things like that. The reality is, though, like on a creative level, it's a strong showing for the Best Picture nominee. And at least that part of it gives people a reason to celebrate. And if Barbie makes, you know, younger people tune in, then all the better.
Yeah. I wonder if, so it's going to the movies. It's not going anywhere necessarily, but just it'll just make that aspect of it will make less money for everyone. It'll be there for real fans of going to the movies, people who want to see something like Anatomy of a Fall or The Zone of Interest or Past Lives at a movie theater. But otherwise, I wonder if those medium-sized grown-up movies really just find their audiences on streaming now.
Yeah, and you know, depending where you sit, you know, literally where you sit, whether you want to sit in the theater or you want to sit at home, I mean, it puts consumers in the driver's seat. Like, that gives consumers the ultimate control. So I think it's an interesting case when you look at this crop of, you know, if you always take the best picture category as like a petri dish of like, you know, a cross section of Hollywood right now, and you've got the mega theatrical blockbusters like Barbie and Oppenheimer, and then you have the ones down the list that people probably saw in their living rooms too. And I think that that's sort of the, you know, a healthy way to think about it from the consumer point of view, but it does not help the studios and the entertainment, major entertainment companies trying to figure out how to make a buck out of this, because not only are the theatrical films hard to bet on, their streaming platforms, unless, you know, other than Netflix, are struggling in a lot of ways too. And they're also trying to figure out, you know, what's working on the streaming platform too. So, I mean, it's funny. It's like, it's, you know, generally, anytime you talk about this kind of question, it's glass half full, glass half empty, and depending on which part of the business you're, you know, looking at it from, determines the answer to your question. You know, there's a lot of movies out there, and there's a lot of ways to watch them. It's just a matter of making stuff that, you know, the regular moviegoers are going to care enough to click on or buy that ticket for.
Yeah, and I've got a lot of movies from last year that I didn't get around to, that I might not have ever gotten around to, but now I can. You know, however I want to do it. John Jurgensen, reporter on the Style News Desk at the Wall Street Journal. John, thanks.
My pleasure. Thanks so much.
And now, some good news with Tanya J. Powers.
Faith Snapp says she's always loved animals. She told Fox 26 Houston that her family has raised horses and goats, quote, as long as I can remember. So it makes sense that she'd pursue a career as a vet. Snapp, who is 22, is legally blind, but hasn't let that slow her down when chasing her dreams. She's been accepted into the Texas Tech University School of Veterinary Medicine. She says she and her twin brother were both born prematurely with limited vision. Snapp has had a guide dog since high school and even worked at local animal clinics. She begins classes in August and hopes to pursue a career working as a mixed animal veterinarian, treating both large and small animals. Snapp says she wants to remind people that no matter what challenges a person is facing, they should not give up on their dreams. She says, quote, anything is possible. Tanya J. Powers, Fox News.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network. Subscribe and listen to the Trey Gowdy Podcast. Former federal prosecutor and four-term U.S. congressman from South Carolina brings you a one-of-a-kind podcast. Subscribe and listen now by going to foxnewspodcasts.com. Subscribe to this podcast at foxnewspodcasts.com.
It's time for your Fox News commentary.
Kennedy, what's on your mind?
Cereal for dinner. Has the world gone mad? Unfortunately, W.K. Kellogg's CEO, Gary Pilnick, he has gotten himself into some deep yogurt because he was telling cash-strapped Americans to enjoy cereal for dinner. And of course, the world and the internet erupted in a cultural firestorm. There has been so much backlash against this man as though it were his Marie Antoinette moment. It's not. And he's right. Especially lower sugar cereals are very, very satisfying at night because it fills your belly. Oftentimes, there's a lot of protein and different vitamins and minerals and everything they advertise. And if you get, you know, 2% low-fat milk, almond milk, it's also a good choice because it is a balanced meal that fills you up and tastes really, really good. So for those of us who have been eating cereal for dinner for decades, we were like, oh, great plan, Gary. I'm glad you enlightened the rest of the world who's been spending way too much money on processed food. So if you can find a lesser processed cereal and enjoy it with your favorite milk, you might just enjoy dinner and not wake up with a hurting gut. But of course, people are always looking for something to be mad at. The era of outrage is in full effect. Whether it's Taylor Swift's lipstick or celebrating at a Chiefs game in a fancy suite, or you name the cause. If it's Israel versus Hamas or cereal for dinner, people will find a reason to get really, really mad at the other side and stamp their foot, assuming that everyone else is going to be in lockstep agreement with them because their grievance is the most important one that's ever been raised in our court of opinion. Well, that is not the case. And they are doing a bad job at Kellogg of responding to the firestorm. They immediately should have rolled out cereal for dinner commercials. That would have been great, showing people how to add cereal into a lovely, balanced family meal that brings everyone together because everyone loves cereal. You can be lactose intolerant and still find ways to love cereal. You can have celiac disease like me and still find ways to love your breakfast treat at an inappropriate time of day. We all remember having breakfast for dinner as kids, and it felt like we were breaking some rule, like we were thumbing our nose at the great authoritarian figure in the sky, but you're not. You're just giving your body what it wants at a time when it really needs it. And sure, Kellogg's and other companies may be guilty of shrinkflation, meaning they have the same size packaging with fewer contents inside. They can remedy that themselves. But this one is actually a win for consumers and manufacturers alike. In order to celebrate, I think tonight, you should have cereal for dinner, but instead of milk, baby, just drown it in champagne and toast yourself for having such a great idea. I'm going to have more on this in a longer format on my podcast, Kennedy Saves the World. You can find me at foxnewspodcast.com. As always, this is Kennedy with your Fox News commentary.
You've been listening to the Fox News Rundown. And now, stay up to date by subscribing to this podcast at foxnewspodcasts.com. Listen ad-free on Fox News Podcasts Plus on Apple Podcasts. And Prime members can listen to the show ad-free on Amazon Music. And for up-to-the-minute news, go to foxnews.com. From the Fox News Podcasts Network.
I'm Janice Dean, Fox News senior meteorologist. Be sure to subscribe to the Janice Dean podcast at foxnewspodcast.com or wherever you listen to your podcasts. And don't forget to spread the sunshine.